Welcome to Footnotes, created by Francis Garrett, a professor of Buddhist studies at the University of Toronto, with Tony Scott, a PhD candidate in Buddhist studies at the University of Toronto. Footnotes is a series of short lectures on research in the field. Each episode features an article or book chapter from an academic book. We aim to make topics of Buddhist studies research freely accessible to students and the public.
Warmest greetings, everyone. This is Tony with a special interview for this installment of Footnotes. Today, we will be speaking with Kate Hartman, assistant professor at the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at the University of Wyoming, about her dissertation titled To See a Mountain, Writing, Place, and Vision in Tibetan Pilgrimage Literature. The music accompanying this interview is a combination of three Tibetan songs performed in the nomad style by a woman named Bhuti from the Mak Township in Bainan County, Tibet, and recorded by David Germano. I hope you enjoy the music and the interview. Maybe together they will inspire you to make your own pilgrimage one day. Dr. Kate Hartman is an assistant professor at the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at the University of Wyoming. She received her PhD from the Committee on the Study of Religion at Harvard in 2020. Her dissertation, titled To See a Mountain, Writing, Place, and Vision in Tibetan Pilgrimage Literature, reimagines pilgrimage as a practice that transforms how Buddhists perceive the world and their place in it. This project is one part of her overall approach to religious studies that sees religion as a force that shapes our experience of the world. And in her study, Dr. Hartman translates sources in classical and modern Tibetan and Sanskrit with a focus on Buddhist ethics and concepts of perception. Welcome to Footnotes, Dr. Hartman. Thank you so much for taking time for us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited to talk about this.
Awesome. Well, before we dive into the dissertation itself, we have you here in front of us. And so I think everyone's kind of interested in you, not just as a scholar, but as a person. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and how your own journey to the study of sacred mountains and pilgrimage to Tibetan Buddhism kind of came about?
Certainly. So I was raised in a multi-religious household. So my father's family was one religion. My mother's family was another religion. I was raised in a third religious tradition. I also grew up in a fairly diverse area, such that a lot of my friends were the children of South Asian immigrants. And so I was just very aware of lots of religious traditions from an early age. And I was one of those kind of weird kids who just loved asking questions about life and death and how we should live. And so all of these things were kind of percolating in my mind. And then when I got to college, I decided, you know, this is a great opportunity to explore these interests a bit more. I'll take a class on, you know, Buddhism, and loved it, ended up taking another, which led to me starting to study some South Asian languages, first Hindi and then Tibetan and Sanskrit. I also started traveling to India over the summers, doing essentially like undergraduate research, and loved it, wanted to continue it. And the whole time I thought that this was just a side interest, that I was really going to go to medical school and make my parents happy in that really sort of traditional way. But as I was sort of engaging in these questions of how do you study the past, how are other ways that we can see the world, I just found them so rewarding and interesting that I decided to try to make a career of it. And so that was how I ended up going to graduate school to study the history of Tibetan Buddhism. And you know, one thing led to another, and then now I'm here talking with you.
Well, I'm sure you would have made a wonderful doctor, but we are glad that you chose the other career path. And we're here today to talk about your thesis, and it revolves around the idea of perception. And you take as your starting point the fact that according to Buddhism, we all misperceive the world around us, including ourselves. So I was hoping you could take a little bit of time to talk about how you approach the idea of perception and in what ways we are misperceiving the world and ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can think of perception broadly in two kinds of registers. The first is just, you know, how we think of the world and our place in it, right? How do we regard the world around us? And this is sort of a general conceptual sense of our place in the world. The second is the concrete physical perception of sensing things out in the world. Perception is this really interesting sense because it kind of mediates between our internal world of ideas, concepts, imagination, feelings, and the external world. And so perception is the sort of interface between those things, and it governs how it is we think the world around us is. And my understanding of the Buddhist tradition is that it's fundamentally concerned with this question of how we perceive the world. There's certainly many ways to read the Buddhist tradition. So this is kind of an interpretive lens, an interpretive move on my part to read the Buddhist tradition in this way. But I do think that there's a good amount of evidence to support this kind of reading. First, you know, the Buddha is the awakened one. This root bud, meaning to wake up, is a fundamental metaphor that's about going from being asleep, eyes closed, dreaming, not perceiving the external world, towards being awake with your eyes open, seeing reality as it really is. We also find lots of metaphors in the Buddhist tradition about light and illumination. Sanskrit and Pali also have the same overlap as we do in English of words between to see and to know, right? We can say, I see your point. I understand what you're saying. And that overlap suggests that there's a lot of consonance between seeing and knowing that the Buddhist tradition makes a lot of use about. I think that the sort of interest in perception can also be seen if we look at sort of early Buddhist ideas about how the world works. So I'm sure the students have learned about the Four Noble Truths. And in the Second Noble Truth, the Buddha is talking about the origin of suffering. And the one that he names specifically in the Buddha's first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana-sutta, is saying that craving is the root of, you know, a lot of the suffering that we experience. But if you look at a lot of the other early Buddhist texts, the Buddha will go on to expand that this craving itself is caused by a kind of fundamental ignorance. And this is ignorance not in the sense of not knowing something, but active delusion of misperceiving the world, of misconstruing reality, of misseeing how things are. And so you can say from this fundamental account that the failure to see reality as it is one of the fundamental causes of suffering. So then the question is, well, what is it that we're misperceiving about the world? I would say fundamentally we're misperceiving what are known as the three marks of existence, which is to say anatta, avidya, and dukkha. And so in particular, you're misperceiving the reality that is impermanence and the consequent reality of interdependence of all things. You're misperceiving reality in terms of taking yourself to be a substantial, independent being and failing to recognize the way all things are interconnected. And so because of these fundamental misperceptions of reality, that leads humans to act in ways that the Buddhist tradition would say are fundamentally unwholesome, that lead to suffering for ourselves and others. And so this is kind of my orienting metaphor for Buddhist traditions of being really interested in this question of perception.
Thank you so much. And it's such a kind of a profound orientation, so fundamental to the Buddhist project overall. And I mean, when we think of how to overcome this kind of misperception, we think of meditation or, you know, reading the sacred texts. But I thought, and I was really struck by this, a major contribution of your dissertation was how you connect pilgrimage with this overall Buddhist project of transforming perception. And to me, that was just, it was so kind of simple, yet something that we had that seemed to have been overlooked by a lot of scholars previously. So how does this novel way of seeing pilgrimage compare with previous scholarship, and what kind of possibilities does it open up for the field moving forward?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just as you said, Buddhism, we can say, has a lot of practices that are aimed at reshaping perception. And this follows from the general orientation that if failure to perceive the world correctly causes suffering, reshape the way you perceive the world, that's going to be a path towards living in a better way. And, you know, some of these practices that you said are meditation, reading the suttas, doing philosophy. And You know, these are the kinds of practices that became most well known in Buddhist studies scholarship. They're the ones that scholars have focused on. And that's because they were seen as the most sophisticated, rational practices, and therefore the most interesting. A lot of early scholars of Buddhism liked what they saw as the kind of high-minded, rational philosophy, and they wanted to get rid of anything that they saw as superstitious or popular. They kind of saw that as beneath them. Maybe it's not even Buddhism, right? Sometimes I've gone to conferences and have told people that I study pilgrimage, and people say, oh, that's like a low popular practice. And so part of what I'm trying to do in my project is to say that actually these popular practices, these practices that everyone did, because it's not that, you know, oh, the lower classes did these and high-ranking scholars or monks didn't do them. No, everyone did these pilgrimage practices. And I'm trying to say that if we take these practices really seriously, we can see that they do respond to the fundamental concerns of the Buddhist tradition, and that they raise really interesting philosophical questions, and they draw our attention to the ways in which Buddhism aims to reshape experience. And as I'm sure we'll talk about a bit more, this isn't just something about the mind transforming itself. It incorporates the use of the body and the senses in order to achieve this sought after transformation.
In this kind of incorporation of the body and the senses, as you mentioned, it seems like pilgrimage is something that all people can do regardless of kind of station or status, you know, of course, with people that maybe aren't able to travel for long distances or don't have the economic means. But it seems like it's a real important part of the whole history of Buddhism. And so in the first chapter, we'll kind of dive into your dissertation now. You try to situate Tibetan pilgrimage practices within the history of Buddhist pilgrimage more generally. So can you share with us some of the common themes throughout the Buddhist world that you discovered when it comes to pilgrimage and the role that pilgrimage is supposed to play over this history? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think for me, some of these themes can be most clearly seen in actually what seems to be the earliest sort of justification for pilgrimage in the Buddhist tradition. And this sort of justification for pilgrimage, or, you know, recommendation to do pilgrimage, occurs in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is the sutta that tells the story of the Buddha's sort of death and how the Buddhist community reacted to it. And so in this sutta, which I should say, some scholars think was added hundreds of years later. Some scholars have suggested that perhaps these passages were added to the Pali canon in order to justify already existing pilgrimage practices. So we're not entirely sure how old these passages are, but I do think that they're important insofar as they've shaped the Buddhist pilgrimage tradition moving forward. And so in this story, the Buddha's on his deathbed. He's about to pass away, and his disciples are surrounding him. They are distraught. They are saying, what are we going to do without you? You've been our teacher for so long. You know, how are we as a community going to survive without you? And Ananda, the Buddha's sort of favorite disciple in particular, is saying, you know, what are we going to do when you're gone? And in response to that question, in response to this perceived absence of the Buddha that's about to happen, he says, Ananda, when I'm gone, people should visit these four sites associated with my life. And people should go to these sites, the sight of which will arouse emotion. And anyone who goes there with a faithful heart will go to heaven upon the dissolution of the body. And so in this story, you know, the interesting thing is that the Buddha says that the sight of these places will arouse emotion. And the Pali word here is samvega, that it, you know, this sort of intensity, this strong emotion. One of my teachers called samvega the kind of oh shit moment where everything becomes real and you realize that, oh gosh, I gotta do something about this. And so the idea is that seeing these places does something to the pilgrim, arouses emotion in a way that stands outside the pilgrim's ability to change themselves, right? Something about the quality of the place, of seeing the place where the Buddha once was but is no longer, is particularly motivating to pilgrims. And we can say that, you know, perhaps folks listening to this can relate this to their own experience of certain places, right? That maybe you walk into, you know, a library or a church or some other place that has some sort of significance to you. And without you intending it, you feel your body kind of changing in response to that place. Or maybe you've gone to a place that's associated with your childhood and all of a sudden you have memories come back that you didn't consciously try to bring up. It's something about the nature of place that transforms you. So this passage really speaks to the power of places to do things that are hard to do ordinarily, right? So imagine if the Buddha had said to Ananda, well, after I'm dead, you can read the suttas, which he did say, but, you know, imagine me. Yeah, that's effective, and that is a practice that Buddhists do, but something about a place, right? Something about our physical body being in a physical place that is associated with the Buddha almost provides this indirect connection to the absent presence of the Buddha. And so also in this story, it talks about going with a sort of a clear and faithful heart. And the word here is pasada, this sort of clear-minded faithfulness related to shraddha, this term for sort of faith or confidence or devotion. And so this notion is that places kind of sustain a person's connection with the Buddha. But that for it to work, you do need to have this kind of affective, faithful devotion. And so I see these sort of themes of, okay, when you go to a place, it's going to change you in some meaningful way. It's going to arouse some important emotion that's going to be motivating to future practice. But also the pilgrim needs to come with the right mindset, this right sort of faithfulness. And so I see one of the themes that runs throughout the Buddhist tradition is one attempting to connect with the absent presence of a Buddha. It's difficult to access a Buddha's presence directly, but if you go to a place associated with them, you can kind of have this more direct access. Two, the importance of faith and devotion to these sites, of the pilgrim's sort of orientation towards them, their state of mind. And then third, the ability of places to transform you in ways that exceed the pilgrim's agency. And so I see those as all operating in a lot of pilgrimage material, both in Buddhism generally, but then also in Tibet specifically.
The idea of the place being able to transform you is especially interesting. And you could even make the argument, as you do, that pilgrimage, the practice of pilgrimage as it goes to Tibet, it too becomes transformed in a certain way. And so I was hoping you could kind of compare the accounts you find about pilgrimage in the Buddhist world with what is unique about Tibetan pilgrimage in particular. And you have a really fascinating discussion about how tantricism or tantric practice has affected Tibetan pilgrimage. So I was hoping you could elaborate a little bit on that for us.
Yeah, definitely. I'd say there's three things that make Tibetan Buddhist pilgrimage different from what we might say is the sort of standard Buddhist model of pilgrimage, as exemplified in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and other places. The first is that Tibetan pilgrimage incorporates indigenous practices. So scholars think that pilgrimage to special places or holy mountains probably predated the entry of Buddhism into Tibet. It's hard to know because much of the historical evidence that we have, most of the texts we have, are after the introduction of Buddhism. And so it's tough to know what was going on before Buddhism arrived in Tibet. But it seems to be the case that there were sort of indigenous practices interested in maintaining purity, getting rid of defilements, and propitiating, that is to say, kind of making happy the spirits or demons or gods that live in the landscape and that are particularly associated with certain kinds of places, holy mountains being one of them. So it seems like there was this existing set of practices of going to and worshiping gods that lived in mountains. And so when Buddhism comes to Tibet, it incorporates those practices. This is like one of the interesting things about Buddhism. When it goes new places, it incorporates, engages with, responds to what was already there. And so Tibetan pilgrimage incorporates elements that we might think of, to gravely oversimplify, oversimplify as Tibetan, but then also elements that are sort of Buddhist, right? The second thing that makes Tibetan pilgrimage, as you said, is the fact that Tibetan Buddhism is overwhelmingly tantric in character. And tantra is, of course, very complex, difficult to summarize. I'm sure you guys could spend a whole large amount of time in this class talking about it. But it's particularly associated with ritual means to attain enlightenment very quickly. And so Tibetan pilgrimage takes place in a largely tantric framework. Tibetan pilgrims will do rituals while they're on pilgrimage. Their understanding of why these places are special is that the mountain itself is the mandala, the celestial palace of a tantric Buddha who is continually preaching the Dharma. And these mountains are holy because of the presence of tantric masters who have been there in the past. So these tantric masters may have defeated some of these demons. They may have defeated non-Buddhist masters. And so part of the reason that you'll go to these mountains is to forge a karmic connection with the tantric Buddha who is held to dwell in the mountain and with the tantric masters who went there. And then the last sort of distinctive element of Tibetan pilgrimage is related, and it's the idea that when you're going to a holy mountain, what that mountain actually is a divine mandala, as I mentioned previously. It is the palace where a tantric Buddha lives and continually preaches the Dharma. But it doesn't appear that way to ordinary perception. It appears to most people at most times as just a pile of rocks. And so Tibetan pilgrimage is structured around this idea that you're going to a holy mountain that looks one way, that has a surface appearance one way, but the deeper reality, if you were to learn to see it as it truly is, you would see that it is in fact a mandala.
So fascinating. And so you talk a little bit at the very end there about kind of seeing it as a holy mountain or seeing it as a mandala. And so one of the primary focuses in your dissertation is on the idea of seeing within regards to the practice of pilgrimage. But you also define pilgrimage, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier, as kind of an embodied ritualized process. So how is the whole body engaged in the practice of pilgrimage? And what is the particular role of walking in the Tibetan tradition of pilgrimage?
Yeah, one of the things that's fascinating about pilgrimage is that it takes your whole body, right? And so one of the genres of literature that I look at in the dissertation is pilgrimage guides, texts written for pilgrims about how you should do pilgrimage, what you should notice about the places that you're going to. And constantly in these texts, they're referring to all the different senses, right? This is how it's going to smell. This is how it's going to look. Here are some of the sounds of birds and burbling streams. Here are the smells. You know, if you drink water from this particular lake, you know, it's going to taste like this clear and delightful, pure water. So all of the senses are involved. What's more, traditionally, pilgrims would have walked to these places from, you know, their homes, which may be quite close. Lots of Tibetan pilgrimages are going to holy places. Maybe there's a mountain associated with your village, so maybe you're not going all that far. But then again, it might be somebody who lives, you know, in eastern Tibet, taking a year to walk all the way to Kailash in western Tibet, and you know, taking that time and undergoing that difficulty in order to experience the holy mountain. You know, one of the things that's kind of different about a practice like doing meditation or doing philosophy is that one really, we can say it's sort of an internally focused practice, right? You're trying to transform your mind. And certainly I would say the body and the senses are involved in that. But pilgrimage really brings the body to the fore. Because what's going to happen when you try to take a year and walk in extremely high elevations, in difficult weather conditions, carrying all the food you have on your back? There's kind of some friction involved. you know, traveling is a difficult practice, and it brings to the fore your body and the way that it normally functions and the limitations that are on it. Similarly, ordinary perception, right? So pilgrims might go to the mountain and say, okay, it's really a palace. It only looks like a pile of rocks. I'm going to learn to see it the way that it really is. And one of the things that emerges from that exercise is recognizing that ordinary perception is not something that you can change so easily, right? There's pushback. The kind of rocks and mountains, the physical landscape resists our attempts to see it in the way that we might want to see it. And that in itself becomes kind of a lesson that we can say affects people in their practice, right? A lot of the pilgrimage experience is of failure and of human limitation and of the inability to be or see the way that you want to be or see. Well, I would just say that, you know, this experience of walking, of getting into your body, is part of kind of recognizing the reality of your situation, right? Mm-hmm. It's easy to kind of, it's one thing to try to close your eyes and visualize the world as a Pure Land or the world as a mandala or the deity in front of you, right? It's a whole different challenge when you are trying to see the physical world in front of you as other than that which it presents itself to your ordinary sense perception.
And one of the really interesting things about that too is that, I mean, some of these landscapes are quite formidable as well, right? And so a real challenge to get to some of these locations. And you talk about all the different landscapes that can be points or sites of pilgrimage, and including, you know, different holy people as well. But mountains particularly seem like a very potent sacred site. And so can you describe the cult of holy mountains, as you put it, in Tibet? And how does this cult relate to similar practices elsewhere in Asia, inside and perhaps outside of Buddhism? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so part of what you're pointing to in that question is that there's lots of different places where one can go on pilgrimage. Some are places associated with the life of the Buddha. You might also go to a temple. You might go to a holy city. You might go to a cave or in Tibet, a lake. People talk about holy people themselves being sites of pilgrimage. But one of the things that, you know, I really focus on is pilgrimage to holy mountains. And mountains are places in the broader Buddhist world where people will go. So you have, you know, pilgrimage to Wu Tai Shan and Ume Shan in China, to places like Kumano in Japan, various other sorts of holy mountains throughout the Buddhist tradition. And it's an interesting question, right? Why do mountains kind of attract this attention? What is it about them, you know? And that's a tough question to answer. I'm reminded of the scholar Mircea Eliade who posed that same question. He said, well, mountains are the closest thing to the sky. So maybe it's just that simple. But, you know, mountains have been important to Buddhism kind of throughout the Buddhist world. And there's different types of practice associated with mountains in each of these different sort of cultural regions. For instance, in China, I'll just speak about Wu Tai Shan, for example. There's a lot written about this mountain, Wu Tai Shan, and pilgrims who go there to see Manjushri, Bodhisattva, who is said to sort of dwell particularly at Wu Tai Shan. And the stories are always about, you know, ordinary average pilgrim going to Wu Tai Shan, and from out of the middle of nowhere, you know, an 8-year-old child or a scrubby-looking old man or, you know, a beggar will sort of emerge from the forests, you know, of the mountain, and the traveler will speak with them, leave, and then later realize, oh, that was Manjushri, right? So that's the kind of typical framework in which pilgrimage at Wu Tai Shan will tend to happen. And that's interestingly different than what happens at these Tibetan pilgrimage mountains, where it is sort of more framed around the goal of learning to see the mountain as it really is. But in either case, it's always involving these same questions of absence and presence, right? Of trying to make a connection with some sort of special being who is otherwise difficult to access. A question of faith and devotion, right? Manjushri is said to appear to those who have faith. And also this question, this idea of engaging the entire body and the physical senses in order to make a connection with the place and the other beings who kind of dwell there.
Thank you so much. This all makes me think that there's this act of seeing and making the connection with the mountain or the sacred site. And then there's this kind of secondary act about writing about the experience. And so you in your work, you engage with a real interesting array of literature on pilgrimage, including you have a pilgrim's journal and then guides for pilgrims and kind of polemics, people arguing back and forth about it. So how do these different forms of literature in Tibet capture the embodied ritual of pilgrimage in particular? And how do they capture the transformation of vision that is the end goal of pilgrimage and the act of walking and reaching this goal?
Yeah, it's one of the things that, you know, traditionally in Buddhist studies, you pick one text or one figure and you do a study of them. And so it was a real thing that I've gotten, you know, some questions about is using lots of different genres of literature to try to get aim at this question. And the question is, you know, how do you transform the way that you see the world? And how did Tibetans think about pilgrimage to holy mountains as a tool for transforming perception of the world? And this is a question that is really difficult to answer. You know, no text sort of sets out with those same questions and says, well, you know, here's the answer. So for me, it was a matter of trying to get as many different perspectives on this same question, because that was going to yield kind of a richer picture, at least I hoped. And of course, what's difficult about that is that each different genre of literature has its own sort of, you know, interesting quirks, its sort of histories, it has its own projects, and you have to be really attentive to reading texts in their own context in a responsible sort of way. But I do think that taking multiple perspectives on a central issue yields something really interesting that I think is valuable. And so part of what I was thinking about is, okay, where does the text stand in relation to this practice? So one example that I read is pilgrimage guides. Picture these as lonely planets for going on pilgrimage. They're telling you what you should do, what you should expect to see. And so in that case, the text is preceding the act of pilgrimage. It's setting up certain kinds of expectations. It's directing pilgrims' attention to certain things that they're going to see or not see, as the case may be. And so the text is kind of shaping the way the pilgrim is going to engage with the place. By contrast, the pilgrim diary is kind of being written a little bit after the fact, right? So it's someone reflecting on what they did see, and again, shaping their understanding of what happened on the pilgrimage and what they're going to be doing continuously. And so in general, I think of writing as part of the practices of seeing. One of the moves that I make in writing about pilgrimage is thinking that, okay, seeing is not just this fact, right? We're just passively receiving sense data and, you know, that's that for pilgrimage. Rather, seeing is an active process, and there are certain practices that construct seeing. And I read, and I argue that writing about pilgrimage is one of these practices of seeing, that writing and reading really does shape how perception happens on pilgrimage.
Yeah, I think you do a wonderful job of bringing these multiple perspectives together, and that's what makes your dissertation so strong. And in particular, you have you brought together two main perspectives, I feel like, in how we approach Buddhist studies as scholars. One is that we often think of Buddhism as an introspective set of practices. So it's focused internally on one's thoughts, habits, and underlying tendencies. But what you do is you show that pilgrimage is also externally focused, one in which the landscapes and mountains have agency over the practitioner. You mentioned that a little bit earlier. So how do you make sense of this apparent tension between the internal and the external in Buddhist practice? And how does your study of pilgrimage help us maybe collapse this divide?
Yeah, definitely. And so the first thing I'll say is that this is not just an apparent tension to you or I, but this is a tension that Tibetan Buddhist thinkers themselves noticed. So, and it troubled a lot of them. So one of the later chapters in my dissertation is called Against Pilgrimage, and it surveys various critiques of pilgrimage internal to the Tibetan tradition. And there's a lot of these critiques that come from various people at various times for various reasons. But one of the persistent themes of these critiques is a skepticism towards engaging external places at all. So Jigme Lingpa, a 17th century master, says that real practice consists of the generation and the completion stages, which is to say two stages of tantric sadhana visualization, two essentially stages of meditation. And he says, if you do those, you can get enlightened without even leaving your bedroom. And so he was criticizing pilgrims. This was in a letter of advice to pilgrims saying, you don't need to do this. This is going to be a big hassle. You're going to get all hot and sweaty and, you know, difficult. And when you're in that state of going through something difficult, what are you going to do? You're going to do unwholesome actions, right? You're going to get angry. You're going to lose control. You're going to cause yourself more bad karma than you're going to do good things. And so there is a definite sort of worry about pilgrimage that exists in the tradition. And so a chapter is saying, okay, if these are concerns that people had about pilgrimage, how do they resolve those concerns? And the answer that I come up with is that Tibetan thinkers thought that for pilgrimage to work, there had to be a conjunction of external and internal forces. So you were going to certain kinds of special places that had certain kinds of special blessings. But it wasn't enough, according to most Tibetan thinkers, to just go there. You also had to have the right sort of orientation towards those places. You had to plug into the kind of network of factors that make pilgrimage worth it. And when you brought this sort of affective devotion, the natural blessings in the pilgrimage place could transform you. And so pilgrimage is very much this thing of engaging the external world. But we can also think of it as something that, as you said, collapses those divides, that the proper sort of successful pilgrimage is mediated by a whole network of factors, right? So the place itself, the previous holy masters that have been at that place, the self-arisen wonders of the pilgrimage place, the faith and devotion of the pilgrim. Pilgrimage is not just a pilgrim going to a place, it's actually invoking this whole network of connections. And so when the pilgrim goes there, they're being transformed by this external place, but they're also bringing something to it to make that effective. And so I think what that points towards is, just as you said, kind of a sense that internal and external are highly related. So one of the things that will come up in tantric commentaries talking about pilgrimage, you know, as outside, so inside, as inside, so outside, that there are these kind of relations between external and internal that, if properly used, can really benefit pilgrims.
Well, you know, you really forced me or compelled me to look at pilgrimage in a whole new light. And this has been a really fascinating conversation. I don't take up too much of your time, but before I let you go, I have to ask, will you be turning this dissertation into a book, or do you have any other projects kind of stemming from this?
Yes, I am currently revising my dissertation into a book manuscript and hope to publish this as a freestanding monograph. So, you know, keep your eyes out for that. And I'm looking to also just, you know, continue this research and think about how these same questions get played out, for instance, in exile or in North American forms of pilgrimage, right? How do these questions of seeing, of presence, of absence, of engaging the external world get reframed as Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism moves into new historical, social, cultural contexts.
Well, thank you so much. And we're all going to look forward to the freestanding monograph. And I'm very grateful for all of your time and for sharing with us your insights on pilgrimage. So yeah, thank you for your time, Dr. Harman. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This was really fun to talk about. And, you know, I hope this listeners and readers enjoy it.
I'm sure they will. Thank you.
This episode of Footnotes was produced by Tony Scott, with sound editing by Jesse Witte. The show's music consists of three different Tibetan songs performed in the nomad style by a woman named Bhuti from a village in the Mak township of Tibet. They were recorded by David Germano. The Footnotes series is created at the University of Toronto in Canada with support from eCampus Ontario.